of the changes there. And so he'd been here for the past 2 hours, learning how the female body moved and operated. Wholly different from learning how a raven flew, how it wrangled the wind. He thought he'd known everything about the female body, how to make a woman purr with pleasure. He was half tempted to find a tent and learn firsthand what certain things felt like. Not an effective use of his time, not with the camp readying for travel. The 13 were on edge. They hadn't yet decided where to go, and hadn't been invited to travel with the Crokins to any of their home hearths, even Glennis's. None of them, however, had looked his way when they'd prowled past. None had recognized him. Dorian had just completed another walking circuit in his little training area when Manon stalked by, silver hair flowing. He paused, no more than a wary Kraken sentinel, and watched her storm through snow and mud as if she were a blade through the world. Manon had nearly passed his training area when she went rigid. Slowly, she turned, nostrils flaring. Those golden eyes swept over him, swift and cutting. Her brows twitched toward each other. Dorian only gave her a lazy grin in return. Then she prowled toward him. I'm surprised you're not groping yourself.
Who says I haven't already?
Another assessing stare. I would have thought you'd pick a prettier form. He frowned down at himself.
I think she's pretty enough.
Manon's mouth tightened.
I suppose this means you're about to go to Morath? Did I say anything of the sort?
He didn't bother sounding pleasant. Manon took a step toward him, her teeth flashing. In this body, he stood shorter than her. He hated the thrill that shot through his blood as she leaned down to growl at him.
We have enough to deal with today, princeling. Do I look as if I'm standing in your way?
She opened her mouth, then shut it. Dorian let out a low laugh and made to turn away. An iron-tipped hand gripped his arm. Strange, for that hand to feel large on his body. Large, and not the slender, deadly thing he'd become accustomed to. Her golden eyes blazed.
If you want a soft-hearted woman who will weep over hard choices and ultimately balk from them, then you're in the wrong bed.
I'm not in anyone's bed right now.
He hadn't gone to her tent any of these nights, not since that conversation in Eelway. She took the retort without so much as a flinch.
Your opinion doesn't matter to me.
Then why are you standing here?
Again, she opened and closed her mouth, then snarled,
Change out of that form.
Dorian smiled again.
Don't you have better things to do right now, Your Majesty?
He honestly thought she might unsheathe those iron teeth and rip out his throat. Half of him wanted her to try. He even went so far as to run one of those phantom hands along her jaw.
You think I don't know why you don't want me to go to Morath?
He could have sworn she trembled. Could have sworn she arched her neck just a little bit, leaning into that phantom touch. Dorian ran those invisible fingers down her neck, trailing them along her collarbones.
Tell me to stay,
he said. And the words had no warmth, no kindness.
Tell me to stay with you, if that's what you want.
His invisible fingers grew talons and scraped over her skin. Manon's throat bobbed.
But you won't say that, will you, Manon?
Her breathing turned jagged. He continued to stroke her neck, her jaw, her throat, caressing skin he'd tasted over and over.
Do you know why?
When she didn't answer, Dorian let one of those phantom talons dig in, just slightly. She swallowed, and it was not from fear. Dorian leaned in close, tipping his head back to stare into her eyes as he purred.
Because while you might be older, might be deadly in a thousand different ways, deep down, you're afraid. You don't know how to ask me to stay, because you're afraid of admitting to yourself that you want it. You're afraid of yourself more than anyone else in the world. You're afraid.
For several heartbeats, she just stared at him. Then she snarled,
"You don't know what you're talking about,"
and stalked away. His low laugh ripped after her. Her spine stiffened. But Manon did not turn back. Afraid of admitting that she felt any sort of attachment. It was preposterous. And it was, perhaps, true.
But it was not her problem. Not right now.
Manon stormed through the readying camp where tents were being taken down and folded, hearths being packed. The 13 were with the Wyverns, supplies stowed in saddlebags. Some of the Crokins had frowned her way, not with anger, but something like disappointment, discontent, as if they thought parting ways was a poor idea. Manon refrained from saying she agreed. Even if the 13 followed, the Crokins would find a way to lose them, use their power to bind the Wyverns long enough to disappear. And she would not lower herself, lower the 13, to become dogs chasing after their masters. They might be desperate for aid, might have promised it to their allies, but she would not debase herself any further. Manon halted at Glennis's camp, the only hearth with a fire still burning. A fire that would always remain kindled. A reminder of the promise she'd made to honor the Queen of Terrasen. A single solitary flame against the cold. Manon rubbed at her face as she slumped onto one of the rocks lining the hearth. A hand rested on her shoulder, warm and slight. She didn't bother to slap it away. Glennis said,
"We're departing in a few minutes. I thought I'd say goodbye."
Manon peered up at the ancient witch.
"Fly well."
It was really all there was left to say. Manon's failure was not due to Glennis, not due to anyone but herself, she supposed.
"You're afraid."
It was true. She had tried, but not really tried to win the Crokins, to let them see any part of her that meant something, to let them see what it had done to her, to learn she had a sister and that she had killed her.
She didn't know how, and had never bothered to learn. "You're afraid."
Yes, she was. Of everything. Glennis lowered her hand from Manon's shoulder.
"May your path carry you safely through war, and back home at last."
She didn't feel like telling the crone there was no home for her, or the 13. Glennis turned her face toward the sky, sighing once. Then her white brows narrowed. Her nostrils flared. Manon leapt to her feet.
"Run,"
Glennis breathed. "Run, now." Manon drew Windcleaver and did no such thing.
"What is it?"
"They're here."
How Glennis had scented them on the wind? Manon didn't care. Not as three Wyverns broke from the clouds, spearing for their camp.
She knew those Wyverns, almost as well as she knew the three riders who sent the Crokins into a frenzy of motion.
The matrons of the Iron Teeth Witch Clans had found them, and come to finish what Manon had started that day in Morath. Chapter 56. The three high witches had come alone. It didn't stop the Crokins from rallying, brooms swiftly airborne, a few of them trembling with what could only be recognition. Manon's grip on Windcleaver tightened at the slight tremor in her hand, as the three witches landed at the edge of Glennis's fire, their wyverns crushing tents beneath them. Asterin and Sorrel were instantly beside her, her second's murmur swallowed by the crack of breaking tents.
"The shadows are airborne, but they've signaled no sign of another unit."
"None of their covens?"
"No, and no sign of Iskra or Petra."
Manon swallowed.
The matrons truly had come alone, had flown in from wherever they'd been gathered, and somehow found them, or tracked them. Manon didn't let the thought settle, that she may have led the three matrons right to this camp. The soft snarls of the Krokins around her, pointed at Manon, said enough of their opinion. The wyverns settled, their long tails curling around them, those deadly poison-slick spikes ready to inflict death. Rushing steps crunched through the icy snow, halting at Manon's side just as Dorian's scent wrapped around her.
Is that?
Yes, she said quietly, heart thundering, as the matrons dismounted and did not raise their hands in request for parley. No, they only stalked closer to the hearth, to the precious flame still burning. Don't engage, Manon warned him and the others, and strode to meet them. It was not the king's battle, no matter what power dwelled in his veins. Glennis was already armed, an ancient sword in her withered hands. The woman was as old as the Yellowlegs matron, yet she stood tall, facing the three high witches. Cressida Blueblood spoke first, her eyes as cold as the iron-spiked crown digging into her freckled brow.
It has been an age, Glennis.
But Glennis's stare, Manon realized, was not on the Blueblood matron, or even on Manon's own grandmother, her black robes billowing as she sneered at Manon. It was on the Yellowlegs matron, hunched and hateful between them. On the crown of stars atop the crone's thinned white hair. Glennis's sword shook slightly. And just as Manon realized what the matron had worn here, Bronwyn appeared at Glennis's side and breathed,
Rhiannon's crown.
Worn by the Yellowlegs matron to mock these witches, to spit on them. A dull roaring began in Manon's ears.
What company you keep these days, granddaughter, said Manon's grandmother.
Her silver-streaked dark hair braided back from her face. A sign enough of their intentions, if her grandmother's hair was in that plait. Battle. Annihilation. The weight of the three high witches' attention pressed upon her. The Krokins gathered behind her shifted as they waited for her response. Yet it was Glennis who snarled in a voice Manon had not yet heard.
What is it that you want?
Manon's grandmother smiled, revealing rust-flecked iron teeth, the true sign of her age.
You made a grave error, Manon Kinslayer, when you sought to turn our forces against us, when you sowed such lies amongst our sentinels regarding our plans. My plans.
Manon kept her chin high.
I spoke only truth, and it must have frightened you enough that you gathered these two to hunt me down and prove your innocence in scheming against them.
The other two matrons didn't so much as blink. Her grandmother's claws had to have sunk deep then, or they simply did not care.
We came,
Cressida seethed, the opposite in so many ways of the daughter who had given Manon the chance to speak.
To at last rid us of a thorn in our sides.
Had Petra been punished for letting Manon walk out of the Omega alive? Did the blue blood air still breathe? Cressida had once screamed in a mother's terror and pain when Petra had nearly plunged to her death. Did that love, so foreign and strange, still hold true? Or had duty and ancient hatred won out? The thought was enough to steel Manon's spine.
You came because we pose a threat.
Because of the threat you pose to that monster you call grandmother.
You came, Manon went on, Windcleaver rising a fraction, because you are afraid.
Manon took a step beyond Glennis, her sword lifting farther.
You came, Manon said, because you have no true power beyond what we give you, and you are scared to death that we're about to take it away.
Manon flipped Windcleaver in her hand, angling the sword downward, and drew a line in the snow between them.
You came alone for that fear.
the others might see what we are capable of. The truth that you have always sought to hide.
Her grandmother tutted.
Listen to you, sounding just like a Kraken with that preachy nonsense.
Manon ignored her. Ignored her and pointed Windcleaver directly at the Yellowlegs matron as she snarled.
That is not your crown.
Something like hesitation rippled over Cressida Blueblood's face. But the Yellowlegs matron beckoned to Manon with iron nails so long they curved downward.
Then come and fetch it from me, traitor.
Manon stepped beyond the line she'd drawn in the snow. No one spoke behind her. She wondered if any of them were breathing. She had not won against her grandmother, had barely survived, and only thanks to luck. That fight, she had been ready to meet her end, to say farewell. Manon angled Windcleaver upward, her heart a steady, raging beat. She would not greet the darkness's embrace today, but they would.
This seems familiar,
her grandmother drawled, legs shifting into attacking position. The other two matrons did the same.
The last Kraken queen, holding the line against us.
Manon cracked her jaw, and iron teeth descended. A flex of her fingers had her iron nails unsheathing.
Not just a Kraken queen this time.
There was doubt in Cressida's blue eyes, as if she'd realized what the other two matrons had not. There. It was there that Manon would strike first, the one who now wondered if they had somehow made a grave mistake in coming here. A mistake that would cost them what they had come to protect. A mistake that would cost them this war and their lives. For Cressida saw the steadiness of Manon's breathing, saw the clear conviction in her eyes, saw the lack of fear in her heart as Manon advanced another step. Manon smiled at the blue blood matron as if to say, yes.
You did not kill me then, Manon said to her grandmother. I do not think you will be able to now.
We'll see about that,
her grandmother hissed and charged. Manon was ready. An upward swing of Windcleaver met her grandmother's first two blows, and Manon ducked the third, turning right into the onslaught of the Yellowlegs matron, who swept up with unnatural speed, feet almost flying over the snow, and slashed for Manon's exposed back. Manon deflected the crone's assault, sending the witch darting back, just as Cressida launched herself at Manon. Cressida was not a trained fighter, not as the Blackbeak and Yellowlegs matrons were. Too many years spent reading entrails and scanning the stars for answers to the three-faced goddess's riddles. A duck to the left had Manon easily evading the sweep of Cressida's nails, and a counter move had Manon driving her elbow into the blue blood matron's nose. Cressida stumbled. The Yellowlegs matron and her grandmother attacked again. So fast. Their three assaults had happened in the span of a few blinks. Manon kept her feet under her, saw where one matron moved and the other left a dangerous gap exposed. She was not a broken-spirited wingleader unsure of her place in the world. She was not ashamed of the truth before her. She was not afraid. Manon's grandmother led the attack, her maneuvers the deadliest. It was from her that the first slice of pain appeared, a rip of iron nails through Manon's shoulder. But Manon swung her sword again and again, iron on steel ringing out across the icy peaks. No, she was not afraid at all. Dorian had never seen fighting like what unfolded before him. Had never seen anything that fast, that lethal. Had never seen anyone move like Manon, a whirlwind of steel and iron. Three against one. The odds weren't in her favor. Not when standing against one of them had left Manon on death's threshold months earlier. Yet where they struck, she was already gone, already parrying. She did not land many blows, but rather kept them at bay. Yet they did not land many either. Dorian's magic writhed, seeking a way out to stop this. But she had ordered him to stand down, and he'd obey. Around him, the Krakens thrummed with fear and dread, either for the fight unfolding or the three matrons who had found them. But Glenys did not tremble. At her side, Bronwyn hummed with the energy of one eager to leap into the fight. Manon and the High Witches sprang apart, breathing heavily. Blue blood leaked down Manon's shoulder, and small slices peppered the three matrons. Manon still remained on the far side of the line she'd drawn, still held it. The dark-haired witch in voluminous black robes spat blue blood onto the snow. Manon's grandmother.
Pathetic. As pathetic as your mother.
A sneer toward Glenys.
And your father.
The snarl that ripped from Manon's throat rang across the mountains themselves. Her grandmother let out a crow's caw of a laugh.
Is that all you can do, then? Snarl like a dog and swing your sword like some human filth? We will wear you down eventually. Better to kneel now and die with some honor intact.
Manon only flung out an iron-tipped hand behind her, fingers splaying in demand as her eyes remained fixed on the matrons. Dorian reached for Damaris, but Bronwyn moved first. The Kraken tossed her sword, steel flashing over snow and sun. Manon's fingers closed on the hilt, the blade singing as she whipped it around to face the High Witches again.
Rhiannon Kraken held the gates for 3 days and 3 nights, and she did not kneel before you, even at the end.
A flash of a smile.
I think I shall do the same.
Dorian could have sworn the sacred flame burning to their left flared brighter. Could have sworn Glenys sucked in a breath, that every Kraken watching did the same. Manon's knees bent, swords rising.
Let us finish what was started then, too.
She attacked, blades flashing. Her grandmother conceded step after step, the other two matrons failing to break past her defenses. Gone was the witch who had slept and wished for death. Gone was the witch who had raged at the truth that had torn her to shreds. And in her place, fighting as if she were the very wind, unfaltering against the matrons, stood someone Dorian had not yet met. Stood a queen of two peoples. The Yellowlegs matron launched an offensive that had Manon yielding a step, then another, swords rising against each slashing blow, yielding only those few steps and nothing more. Because Manon, with conviction in her heart, with utter fearlessness in her eyes, was wholly unstoppable. The Yellowlegs matron pushed Manon close enough to the line that her heels nearly touched it. The other two witches had fallen back, as if waiting to see what might happen. For a hunched crone, the Yellowlegs witch was the portrait of nightmares, worse than Baba Yellowlegs had ever been. Her feet barely seemed to touch the ground, and her curved iron nails drew blood wherever they slashed. Manon's swords blocked blow after blow, but she made no move to advance, to push back, though Dorian saw several chances to do so. Manon took the slashings that left her arm and side bleeding, but she yielded no further ground, a wall against which the Yellowlegs matron could not advance. The crone let out a snarl, attacking again and again, senseless and raging. Dorian saw the trap the moment it happened. Saw the side that Manon left open, the bait laid on a silver platter. Worked into a fury, the Yellowlegs matron didn't think twice before she lunged, claws out. Manon was waiting. Lost in her bloodlust, the Yellowlegs matron's horrible face lit with triumph as she went for the easy killing blow that would rip out Manon's heart. The Blackbeak matron barked in warning, but Manon was already moving. Just as those curved claws tore through leather and skin, Manon twisted to the side and brought down Windcleaver upon the Yellowlegs matron's outstretched neck. Blue blood sprayed upon the snow. Dorian did not look away this time, at the head that tumbled to the ground, at the brown-robed body that fell with it. The two remaining matrons halted. None of the Krakens behind Dorian so much as spoke, as Manon stared down pitilessly at the bleeding torso of the Yellow Legs matron. No one seemed to breathe at all. As Manon plunged Bronwyn's sword into the icy earth beneath, and bent to take the crown of stars from the Yellow Legs witch's fallen head, he had never seen a crown like it. A living, glowing thing that glittered in her hand. As if 9 stars had been plucked from the heavens and set to shine along the simple silver band. The crown's light danced over Manon's face as she lifted it above her head and set it upon her unbound white hair. Even the mountain wind stopped. Yet a phantom breeze shifted the strands of Manon's hair as the crown glowed bright, the white stars shining with cores of cobalt and ruby and amethyst. As if it had been asleep for a long, long time, and now awoke. That phantom wind pulled Manon's hair to the side, silver strands brushing across her face. And beside him, around him, the 13 touched 2 fingers to their brow in deference, in allegiance to the queen who stared down the 2 remaining high witches. The Kraken queen, crowned anew. The sacred fire leaped and danced, as if in joyous welcome. Manon scooped up Bronwyn's sword, lifting it in Windcleaver, and said to the blue-blood matron, the witch appearing barely a few years older than Manon herself, "Go." The blue-blood witch blinked, eyes wide with what could only be fear and dread. Manon jerked her chin toward the wyvern waiting behind the witch. "Tell your daughter all debts between us are paid, and she may decide what to do with you. Take that other wyvern out of here." Manon's grandmother bristled, iron teeth flashing as if she'd bark a counter command to the blue blood matron. But the witch was already running for her wyvern. Spared by the Kraken queen, on behalf of the daughter who had given Manon the gift of speaking to the iron teeth. Within seconds, the blue blood matron was in the skies, the Yellow Legs witch's wyvern soaring beside her, leaving Manon's grandmother alone. Leaving Manon with swords raised and a crown of stars glowing upon her brow. Manon was glowing, as if the stars atop her head pulsed through her body. A wondrous and mighty beauty, like no other in the world. Like no one had ever been, or would be again. And slowly, as if savoring each step, Manon stalked toward her grandmother. Manon's lips curved into a small smile while she advanced on her grandmother. Warm, dancing light flowed through her, as unfaltering as what had poured into her heart these past few bloody minutes. She did not balk, did not fear. The crown's weight was slight, like it had been crafted of moonlight. Yet its joyous strength was a song, undimming before the sole high witch left standing. So Manon kept walking. She left Bronwyn's sword a few feet away, left Windcleaver several feet past that. Iron nails out, teeth ready. Manon paused barely 5 steps from her grandmother. A hateful, wasted scrap of existence. That's what her grandmother was. She had never realized how much shorter the matron stood, how narrow her shoulders were, or how the years of rage and hate had withered her. Manon's smile grew, and she could have sworn she felt 2 people standing at her shoulder. She knew no one would be there if she looked, knew no one else could see them, sense them standing with her, standing with their daughter against the witch who had destroyed them. Her grandmother spat on the ground, baring her rusted teeth. This death, though, it was not her death to claim. It did not belong to the parents whose spirits lingered at her side, who might have been there all along, leading her toward this, who had not left her, even with death separating them. No, it did not belong to them, either. She looked behind her, toward the second waiting beside Dorian. Tears slid down Astarin's face, of pride and relief. Manon beckoned to Asterin with an iron-tipped hand. Snow crunched, and Manon whirled, angling to take the brunt of the attack. But her grandmother had not charged. Not at her. No. The Blackbeak matron sprinted for her wyvern. Fleeing. The Krakens tensed, fear giving way to wrath as her grandmother hauled herself into the saddle. Manon raised a hand. Let her go. A snap of the reins, and her grandmother was airborne, the great wyvern's wings blasting them with foul wind. Manon watched as the wyvern rose higher and higher. Her grandmother did not look back before she vanished into the skies. When there was no trace of the matrons left but blue blood and a headless corpse staining the snow, Manon turned toward the Krakens. Their eyes were wide, but they made no move. The 13 remained where they were, Dorian with them. Manon scooped up both swords, sheathing Windcleaver across her back, and stalked toward where Glennis and Bronwyn stood, monitoring her every breath. Wordlessly, Manon handed Bronwyn her sword, nodding in thanks. Then she removed the crown of stars and extended it toward Glennis. This belongs to you, she said, her voice low. The Krakens murmured, shifting. Glennis took the crown, and the stars dimmed. A small smile graced the crone's face. No, she said. It does not. Manon didn't move, as Glennis lifted the crown and set it again on Manon's head. Then the ancient witch knelt in the snow. What was stolen has been restored. What was lost has come home again. I hail thee. Manon Kraken, Queen of Witches. Manon stood fast against the tremor that threatened to buckle her legs. Stood fast as the other Krakens, Bronwyn with them, dropped to a knee. Dorian, standing amongst them, smiled, brighter and freer than she'd ever seen. And then the 13 knelt, two fingers going to their brows as they bowed their heads, fierce pride lighting their faces. Queen of Witches, Kraken and Blackbeak declared as one voice. As one people. Chapter 57. An hour before dawn, the keep and two armies beyond it were stirring. Rowan had barely slept, and instead lain awake beside Aelin, listening to her breathing. That the rest of them slumbered soundly was testament to their exhaustion, though Lorcan had not found them again. Rowan was willing to bet it was by choice. It was not fear or anticipation of battle that had kept Rowan up. No, he'd slept well enough during other wars. But rather the fact that his mind would not stop looping him from thought to thought to thought. He'd seen the numbers camped outside. Volg, human men loyal to Erewhon, some fell beasts. Yet nothing like the Ilkin or the Wordhounds, or even the witches. Aelin could wipe them away before the sun had fully risen. A few blasts of her power and that army would be gone. Yet she had not presented it as an option in their planning last night. He'd seen the hope shining in the eyes of the people in the keep, the awe of the children as she'd passed. The Firebringer, they'd whispered. Aelin of the Wildfire. How soon would that awe and hope crumble today, when not a spark of that fire was unleashed? How soon would the men's fear turn rank when the Queen of Terrasen did not wipe away Morath's legions? He hadn't been able to ask her. Had told himself to. Had roared at himself to ask these past few weeks, when even their training hadn't summoned an ember. But he couldn't bring himself to demand why she wouldn't or couldn't use her power. Why they had seen or felt nothing of it after those initial few days of freedom. Couldn't ask what Maeve and Cairn had done to possibly make her fear or hate her magic enough that she didn't touch it. Worry and dread gnawing at him. Rowan slipped from the room. The din of preparations greeting him the moment he entered the hall. A heartbeat later, the door opened behind him, and steps fell into sync with his own, along with a familiar, wicked scent. They burned her. Rowan glanced sidelong at Fenris.
What?
But Fenris nodded to a passing healer, Cairn, and Maeve through her orders.
Why are you telling me this?
Fenris, blood oath or no, what he'd done for Aelin or no, was not privy to these matters. No, it was between him and his mate, and no one else. Fenris threw him a grin that didn't meet his eyes. You were staring at her half the night. I could see it on your face. You're all thinking it. Why doesn't she just burn the enemy to hell? Rowan aimed for the washing station down the hall. A few soldiers and healers stood along the metal trough, scrubbing their faces to shake the sleep or nerves. Fenris said, he put her in those metal gauntlets. And one time, he heated them over an open brazier. There, he stumbled for words, and Rowan could barely breathe. It took the healers 2 weeks to fix what he did to her hands and wrists. And when she woke up, there was nothing but healed skin. She couldn't tell what had been done and what was a nightmare. Rowan reached for one of the ewers that some of the children refilled every few moments and dumped it over his head. Icy water bit into his skin, drowning out the roaring in his ears. Cairn did many things like that. Fenris took up a ewer himself and splashed some into his hands before rubbing them over his face. Rowan's hands shook as he watched the water funnel toward the basin set beneath the trough. You're claiming marks, though? Fenris wiped his face again. No matter what they did to her, they remained. Longer than any other scar, they stayed. Yet her neck had been smooth when he'd found her. Reading that thought, Fenris said, the last time they healed her, right before she escaped. That's when they vanished. When Maeve told her that you had gone to Terrasen, the words hit like a blow. When she had lost hope that he was coming for her. Even the greatest healers in the world hadn't been able to take that from her until then. Rowan wiped his face on the arm of his jacket. Why are you telling me this? He repeated. Fenris rose from the trough, drying his face with the same lack of ceremony. So you can stop wondering what happened. Focus on something else today. The warrior kept pace beside him as they headed for where they'd been told a meager breakfast would be laid out. And let her come to you when she's ready.
She's my mate, Rowan growled. You think I don't know that?
Fenris could shove his snout into someone else's business. Fenris held up his hands. You can be brutal when you want something.
I'd never force her to tell me anything she wasn't ready to say.
It had been their bargain from the start, part of why he'd fallen in love with her. He should have known then, during those days in Mistward, when he found himself sharing parts of himself, his history, that he'd never told anyone. When he found himself needing to tell her. In fragments and pieces, yes, but he'd wanted her to know. And Aelin had wanted her to hear it. All of it. They discovered Aelin and Elide already at the buffet table, grim-faced as they plucked up pieces of bread and cheese and dried fruit. No sign of Gavriel or Lorcan. Rowan came up behind his mate and pressed a kiss to her neck, right to where his new claiming marks lay. She hummed and offered him a bite of the bread she'd already dug into while gathering the rest of her food. He obliged, the bread thick and hearty, then said,
You were asleep when I left a few minutes ago,
yet you somehow beat me to the breakfast table. Another kiss to her neck.
Why am I not surprised?
Elide laughed beside Aelin, piling food onto her own plate. Aelin only elbowed him as he fell into line beside her. The four of them ate quickly, refilled their water skins at the fountain in an interior courtyard, and set about finding armor. There was little on the upper levels that was fit for wearing, so they descended into the keep, deeper and deeper, until they came across a locked room. Should we? Or is it rude? Aelin mused, peering at the wooden door. Rowan sent a spear of his wind aiming for the lock and splintered it apart.
Looks like it was already open when we got here,
he said mildly. Aelin gave him a wicked grin, and Fenris pulled a torch off its bracket in the narrow stone hallway to illuminate the room beyond.
Well, now we know why the rest of the keep is a piece of shit, Aelin said, surveying the trove. He's kept all the gold and fun things down here.
Indeed, his mate's idea of fun things was the same as Rowan's. Armor and swords, spears and ancient maces.
He couldn't have distributed this?
Elide frowned at the racks of swords and daggers.
It's all heirlooms, said Fenris, approaching one such rack and studying the hilt of a sword. Ancient, but still good.
Really good, he added, pulling a blade from its sheath. He glanced at Rowan.
This was forged by an Asterian blacksmith.
From a different age,
Rowan mused, marveling at the flawless blade, its impeccable condition.
When Fae were not so feared.
Are we just going to take it? Without even Kaol's permission?
Elide chewed on her lip. Aelin snickered.
Let's consider ourselves swords for hire, and as such, we have fees that need to be paid.
She hefted a round golden shield, its edges beautifully engraved with a motif of waves, also Asterian made, judging by the craftsmanship. Likely for the Lord of Aniel, the Lord of the Silver Lake.
So, we'll take what we're owed for today's battle,
and spare his lordship the task of having to come down here himself.
Gods, he loved her. Fenris winked at Elide.
I won't tell if you don't, lady.
Elide blushed, then waved them onward.
Collect your earnings, then.
Rowan did.
He and Fenris found armor that could fit them, in certain areas. They had to forego the entire suit, but took pieces to enforce their shoulders, forearms, and shins. Rowan had just finished strapping greaves on his legs when Fenris said,
We should bring some of this up for Lorcan and Gavriel.
Indeed, they should.
Rowan eyed other pieces and began collecting extra daggers and blades, then sections from another suit that might fit Lorcan. Fenris doing the same for Gavriel.
You must charge a great deal for your services. Elite muttered,
even while the Lady of Peranth tied a few daggers to her own belt.
I need some way to pay for my expensive tastes, don't I?
Aelin drawled, weighing a dagger in her hands.
But she hadn't donned any armor yet.
And when Rowan gave her an inquiring glance, Aelin jerked her chin toward him.
Head upstairs. Track down Lorcan and Gavriel. I'll find you soon.
Her face was unreadable for once. Perhaps she wanted a moment alone before battle. And when Rowan tried to find any words in her eyes, Aelin turned toward the shield she'd claimed, as if contemplating it.
So Rowan and Fenris headed upstairs, Elide helping to haul their stolen gear.
No one stopped them. Not with the sky turning to gray and soldiers rushing to their positions on the battlements.
Rowan and Fenris didn't have far to go. They'd be stationed by the gates at the lower level, where the battering rams might come flying through if Morath got desperate enough. On the level above them, Kaol sat astride his magnificent black horse, the mare's breath curling from her nostrils. Rowan lifted a hand in greeting, and Kaol saluted back before gazing toward the enemy army. The Khaganate would make the first maneuver. The initial push to get Morath moving.
I always forget how much I hate this part, Fenris muttered. The waiting before it begins.
Rowan grunted his agreement. Gavriel prowled up to them, Lorcan a dark storm behind him.
Rowan wordlessly handed the latter the armor he'd gathered.
Courtesy of the Lord of Anio.
Lorkin gave him a look that said he knew Rowan was full of shit, but began efficiently donning the armor, Gavriel doing the same. Whether the soldiers around them marked that armor, whether Kaol recognized it, no one said a word. Far out, the gray sky lightening further, Morath stirred to discover the Khaganate's golden army already in place. And as a lone rook screeched its challenge, the Khaganate advanced. Foot soldiers in perfect lines marched, spears out, shields locked rim to rim. The Dargon cavalry flanked either side, a force of nature ready to herd Morath to where they wanted them. And above, flapping into the skies, the Rukin readied their bows and marked their targets.
Ready now?
Kaol called out to the men of his keep. Armor clanked as men shifted, their fear stuffing itself up Rowan's nose. This would be it. Today. Whether that hope remained or fractured. Already, the awakening sky revealed two siege towers being hauled toward them, right to the wall. Far closer than Rowan had last noted when flying overhead last night. Morath, it seemed, had not been sleeping either. The Rooks would remain back with their own army, driving Morath to the keep, to be picked off here one by one.
We have minutes until that first tower makes contact with the wall, Gavriel observed.
A scan of the battlements, the soldiers atop them, revealed no sign of Aelin.
Lorkin indeed muttered, someone better tell her to stop primping and get here.
Rowan snarled in warning. The clash of armored feet and shields was as familiar as any song. Morath's foot soldiers aimed for the keep walls, spears at the ready. At the other end of the host, soldiers faced away, spears and pikes angled to intercept the Khaganate's army. A horn blasted from deep in the Khaganate ranks, and arrows flew. The mass of Morath soldiers didn't so much as flinch or look behind to see what became of their rear lines.
Ladders, Fenris murmured, pointing with his chin toward the ripple through the lines.
Massive siege ladders of iron parted the crowd.
They're making this their all-out assault, then,
Lorkin said with equal quiet. All of them careful not to let the nearby men hear.
They'll try to break into the keep before the Khaganate can break them.
Archers!
Kaol's bellow rang out. Behind them, down the battlements, bows groaned. Fenris unslung the bow across his back and knocked an arrow into place. Rowan kept his own bow strapped across his back, the quiver untouched, Gavriel and Lorkin doing the same. No need to waste them on a few soldiers when their aim might be needed with far worse targets later in the day. But one of them had to be noted felling soldiers, for whatever it would do to rally their spirits. And Fenris, as fine an archer as Rowan, he'd admit, would do just fine. Rowan followed the line of Fenris's arrowhead to where he'd marked one of the bearers of a siege ladder.
Make it impressive,
he muttered.
Mind your own business,
Fenris muttered back, tracking his target with the tip of his arrow as he awaited Kaol's order. If Aelin didn't arrive within another moment, he'd have to leave the battlements to find her. What in hell had held her up? Lorkin drew his ancient blade, which Rowan had witnessed felling soldiers in kingdoms far from here, in wars far longer than this one.
They'll head for the gates when that siege tower docks,
Lorkin said, glancing from the battlements to the gate a level below, the small bastion of men in front of it. Trees had been felled to prop up the metal doors, but should a solid enough group of enemy soldiers swarm it, they might get those supports and the heavy locks down within minutes, and open the gates to the hordes beyond.
We don't let them get that far,
Rowan said, eyeing up the massive tower lumbering closer. Soldiers teamed behind it, waiting to scale its interior.
Kaol brought the tower down the other day without our help. It can happen again.
Volley!
Kaol's roar echoed off the stones, and arrows sang. Like a swarm of locusts, they swept upon the soldiers marching below. Fenris's arrow found its mark with lethal precision. Within a heartbeat, another was on its tail. A second soldier at the siege ladder fell. Where the hell was Aelin? Morath didn't halt, marched right over the soldiers who fell on their front lines. The pulse of human fear down the battlements rippled against his skin. The cadre would have to strike fast and strike well to shake it away. The siege tower lumbered closer. One glance from Rowan had him and his friends moving toward the spot it would now undeniably strike upon the battlements. Close enough to the stairs down to the gate. Morath had chosen the location well. Some of the soldiers they passed were praying. A shuddering push of words into the frigid morning air. Lorcan said to one of them,
Save your breath for the battle, not the gods.
Rowan shot him a look. But the man, gaping at Lorcan, quieted. Kaol ordered another volley, and arrows flew, Fenris firing as he walked. As if he were barely bothered. Still, the whispered prayers continued down the line, swords shaking along with them. Up by Kaol, the soldiers held firm, faces solid. But here, on this level of the battlements, those faces were pale, wide-eyed.
Someone better say something inspiring, Fenris said through gritted teeth, firing another arrow. Or these men are gonna piss themselves in a minute.
For a minute was all they had left as the first siege tower inched closer.
You've got the pretty face, Lorcan retorted. You'd do a better job of it.
It's too late for speeches, Rowan cut in before Fenris could reply.
Better to show them what we can do.
They positioned themselves on the wall, right in the path of the bridge that would snap down over the battlement. He drew his sword, then thumbed free the hatchet at his side. Gavriel unsheathed twin blades from across his back, falling into flanking position at Rowan's right. Lorcan planted himself on his left. Fenris took the rear, to catch any who got through their net. The mortal men clustered behind them. The gates shuddered under the impact of Morath at last. Rowan steadied his breathing, readying his magic to rip through Volg lungs. He'd fell a few with his blades first, to show how easily it could be done, that Morath was desperate and victory would be near. The magic would come later. The siege tower groaned as it slowed to a stop. Just as the wall under them shuddered at its impact, Fenris whispered,
Holy gods.
Not at the bridge that snapped down, soldiers teeming in the dark depths inside, but at who emerged from the keep archway behind them. What emerged? Rowan didn't know where to look. At the soldiers pouring out of the siege tower, leaping onto the battlements. Or at Aelin. At the Queen of Terrasen. She'd found armor below the keep. Beautiful, pale gold armor that gleamed like a summer dawn. Holding back her braided hair, a diadem lay flush against her head. Not a diadem, but a piece of armor, part of some ancient set for a lady long since buried. A crown for war. A crown to wear into battle. A crown to lead armies. There was no fear on her face, no doubt, as Aelin hefted her shield, flipping Goldrin in her hand once before the first of Morath's soldiers was upon her. A swift upward strike cleaved the Morath grunt from navel to chin. His black blood sprayed, but she was already moving, flowing like a stream around a rock. Rowan launched into movement, his blades finding their marks. But still, he watched her. Aelin slammed her shield against an oncoming warrior, Goldrin slicing through another before she plunged the blade into the soldier she'd deflected. She did it again and again, all while heading toward that siege tower, unhindered, unleashed. A call went down the line. The queen has come. Soldiers waiting their turn whirled toward them. Aelin took on three Volg soldiers and left them dying on the stones. She planted her line before the gaping maw of that siege tower, right in the path of those teeming hordes. Every moment of the training she'd done on the ship here, on the road, every new blister and callus, all to rebuild herself for this. The queen has come. Goldrin unfaltering, her shield an extension of her arm, Aelin glowed like the sun that now broke over the Coggin's army as she engaged each soldier that hurtled her way. 5, 10, she moved and moved and moved, ducking and swiping, shoving and flipping, black blood spraying, her face the portrait of grim, unbreaking will. The queen, the men shouted, to the queen! And as Rowan fought his way closer, as that cry went down the battlements and Aniel men ran to aid her, he realized that Aelin did not need an ounce of flame to inspire men to follow. That she had been waiting, yanking at the bit, to show them what she, without magic, without any godly power, might do. He'd never seen such a glorious sight. In every land, every battle, he had never seen anything as glorious as Aelin before the throat of the siege tower, holding the line. Dawn breaking around them, Rowan loosed a battle cry and tore into Morath. This first battle would set the tone. It would set the tone and send a message. Not to Morath.
Impress us, Hisar had said.
So she would. So she'd picked the golden armor and her battle crown, and waited until dawn, until that siege tower slammed into the battlements before unleashing herself. To keep the men here from breaking, to wipe away the fear festering in their eyes, to convince the Khaganate royals of what she might do, what she could do. Not a threat, but a reminder. She was no helpless princess. She had never been. Goldrin sang with each swipe, her mind as cool and sharp as the blade, while she assessed each enemy soldier, their weapons, and took them down accordingly. She dimly knew that Rowan fought at her side, Gavriel and Fenris battling near her left flank. But she was keenly aware of the mortal men who leaped into the fray with cries of defiance. They'd made it this far. They would survive today, too. And the Khaganate royals would know it. Galloping hooves drowned out the battle. And then Kaol was there, sword flashing, driving into the unending tide that rushed from the tower's entrance. To Lord Kaol, to the queen! How far they both were from Rifthold. From the assassin and the captain. Arrows rose from the army beyond the wall, but a wave of icy wind snapped them into splinters before they could find any marks. A dark blur plunged past, and then Lorcan was at the siege tower's mouth, his sword swinging so fast Aelin could barely follow it. He battled his way across the metal bridge of the tower into the stairwell beyond, like he'd fight his way down the ramps and onto the battlefield itself. Below, a boom began. Morath had brought in their battering ram. Aelin smiled grimly. She'd bring them all down, then Erewhon, and then she'd unleash herself upon Maeve. At the opposite end of the field, the Coggin's army pushed, gaining the field step by step. Not helpless, not contained, never again. Death became a melody in her blood, every movement a dance, as the tide of soldiers pouring from the tower slowed, as if Lorcan was indeed forcing his way down the interior. Those who got past him met her blade, or Rowan's. A flash of gold, and Gavriel had slaughtered his way into the siege tower as well, twin blades a whirlwind. What Lorcan and the lion would do upon reaching the bottom, how they'd dislodge the tower, she didn't know. Didn't think about it. Not from this place of killing and movement, of breath and blood. Of freedom. Death had been her curse and her gift and her friend for these long, long years. She was happy to greet it again, under the golden morning sun.
Chapter 58
Elide wasn't even on the battlements. and she already wished to never endure another war again. The soldiers who were hauled in, their injuries? She didn't know how the healers were so calm, how Irene Westfall worked so steadily while a man was screaming, 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 as his internal organs poked through the gash in his belly. The keep shook every now and then, and Elide hated herself for being glad she didn't know what it meant. Even as it ate away at her, not knowing how her companions fared. If the Coggins army was close enough so that this nightmare could end soon, it would be hours yet. The dark-skinned, sharp-eyed healer named Arisha had claimed, when Elide had vomited upon seeing a man whose shin bone stuck clean through his leg. Hours yet until it was over, the terse healer had chided. So she'd better finish heaving and get back to work. Not that there was much Elide could do. Despite the generous gift of power that ran through the Lochan bloodline, she possessed no magic, no gifts beyond reading people and lying. But she helped the healers pin down thrashing men, rushed to get bandages, hot water, and whatever salves or herbs the healers calmly requested. None of them shouted. They only raised their voices, magic glowing bright around them, if a soldier was shrieking too loudly for their words to be heard. The sun was barely over the horizon, judging by the light at the windows set high in the great hall. And so many already lay injured. So many. Still, they kept coming, and Elide kept moving, her limp becoming a dull, then a sharp ache. A minor pain compared to what the soldiers endured, compared to what they faced on the battlements. She didn't let herself think of her friends, didn't let herself think of Lorcan, who had not come to the chamber last night and had not sought them out this morning. As if he didn't want to be near her, as if he'd taken every hateful word she'd spoken to heart. So Elide aided the clear-eyed healers, held down screaming, pleading men, and did not stop. Farasha did not balk from the Morath soldiers who made it onto the battlements, from the ones who emerged from the